The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl, Holly, and I am back today with a super special episode for you guys. It's Monday, which means another Missing Monday episode. And for those that are new to the podcast, first of all, welcome. Missing Mondays is a segment that was created to help keep missing persons' name and information in the media the best that I can, and to hopefully help aid in their return home. My goal with Missing Mondays is to keep these stories alive and bring awareness to all missing persons' cases. It is also to remind the families of the missing that their loved one is not forgotten. Often when the hype of these missing persons cases dies down, the families are left feeling forgotten. And so I want them to know that their loved one and their story matters to me and my listeners, and we will continue to share their story and their name until they come home. Now, today's episode, if you noticed from the title, is going to have an exclusive interview with a woman named Suzanne Timms. Suzanne and I first connected on TikTok, and some of you may actually already follow her. Her username is Patty's Voice 22. Suzanne has been using TikTok to share her mom's story. This episode has been a few years in the making, and I was finally able to sit down with Suzanne last month to learn all of the details of her mom's case. I just want to start off by saying thank you, Suzanne, for not only sharing her story with me and my listeners, but for continuing to fight not only for your mom, but also for other missing people. Make sure that you guys go and follow her on TikTok to help share this story. It takes just 2 seconds to share these missing person stories when you see them pop up on social media. I will have the direct link to her TikTok as well as the Facebook page in the description of today's episode. So make sure that you check that out and show some love and support for Suzanne and her mission to get answers for her mom. So without further ado, please allow me to introduce you to Suzanne Timms.
Those of you who know me know that I am Suzanne Timms. However, I didn't start out as Suzanne Timms. Back in 1976, I was a little girl living in my home with Ralph and Patricia Otto, and I was living with my sister Natalie, and my name at the time was Dallas Otto. And I will get to why I am no longer Dallas Otto. In August of 1976, my parents had been through a recent separation. So that spring, my mom had moved out, took us to an apartment, got her own place. And when Mother's Day rolled around, she started feeling those twinges of like, I don't think I should keep my girls away from their father. And even though she had had a brief relationship with a young man during that time, while they were legally separated, she filed for divorce. She broke off that relationship, went back with my father, and in August of 1976 is when they have this horrible confrontation. She is a student at the Valley Business College in Lewiston, Idaho, where she had been born and raised. Her father was a firefighter. Mother was a stay-at-home mom for many years with their family, very well-known local family, very supportive family, who, when she got married to my father, they supported that relationship, despite the fact that my father was 18 years older than my mother at the time. So again, in 1976, my mom's a college student. She comes to her parents' house to pick up my sister and I after her courses, and she returned home that night, August 31st, 1976. We usually slept in the bedroom across the hall from our parents, and that night she chose to put us downstairs in the basement, which I don't like the basement. I don't like being down there. I knew something was not right. So when Nabby and I started to hear yelling and screaming from upstairs, I snuck up the stairs to go check and see what was happening. I don't know what I thought I was going to do at the age of three, but when I came up the stairs, I peeked through these wrought iron railing and I saw my parents hitting each other, like physically hitting each other, him slapping her, her hitting him back. And then he grabbed her by the neck and pushed her up against the wall and drug her out of my sight. And I just remember being very frightened and I ran back downstairs and I'm telling my sister that something bad is happening and she's trying to comfort me. Next thing I know, it's morning time because I've obviously fallen asleep and woke up. And my father's in a big hurry to get out of the house. He loads us up into her car and brings us over to his girlfriend's house. She's leaving to go to California, and he was going to help her move that day, which may have very well been a reason that they had an argument, because I don't think I would be okay with my husband helping his girlfriend move. Anyway, I had asked this girlfriend if she was going to be our new mommy, because on the way over there, our father told us that Patty had left. She did not want to be a mother anymore, and she would not be coming home. As a concerned 3-year-old, obviously, I know I need a mother. So I asked the girlfriend if she's going to be our new mommy. And she explains to me that no, that she's leaving. They're moving to California, and I don't ever see her again. My dad then takes us to our mother's sister's house, and he leaves us there. And he tells her that they had an argument and that he was going to go look for her. We didn't see him for months. He left us there for months.
Since we know that Suzanne's father wasn't the one to report her as missing, I asked who actually filed that official report.
My grandpa and my aunt, who had us in her care, she said the minute that dad brought both of us and said, I have to go look for Patty because she can't find her, she said, my mom has never left us in his care. Why? I said, why? Why would my mom never leave us in his care? And she said, well, your dad was a raging alcoholic and she couldn't trust you guys with him. Is it that, or is it that he was a pedophile? I don't know, but he never had the two of us together alone. So she said, the minute that he said, oh, yeah, I'm going to go look for her because she left, Aunt Alice was like, something's really wrong. And so she called grandpa and they said, hey, Ralph says that Patty left last night. She left mad last night and that he's going to go look for her. And they were like, no way. If she left, she would have went right back to my grandparents' house or she would have went to her sister's house. She's there every day. Every single day she's there. So they're like, she would have been here. So they checked the hospitals, they did all that stuff, and it's like, oh, no. No, this is something big red flag. Something's definitely not right. She would not leave the girls alone. She disappears August 31st, about between 11 and 12 o'clock at night. So the first is when we show up at her house late in the evening because we'd been at the girlfriend's house all day and it's in the evening. So that evening, they try to find, call the hospitals, they try all our friends. On September 2nd, they're like, no, we're calling this in. She's 100% a missing person. We've done our search. And yeah, if you look online, you'll see that she was last seen September 2nd. And all that's wrong because I have the police reports that show that she was last seen August 31st, but the actual report's done September 2nd.
Though Ralph said that he was dropping the girls off so he could go and look for Patty, this is what he was doing instead.
In that time that my dad should be searching for my mother, he goes to his local bar that he has gone to for many decades, and he's complaining about the Lewiston Police Department harassing him, is what he calls it, for investigating the case because they're there at the house regularly. Where is she? Have you heard from her? You know, what have you done to her? And he says to the bartender, hey, you told me in the past that you knew people that could get rid of people, and I'm needing to get rid of Captain Ayler of the Lewiston Police Department. Can you set me up with somebody who you know? And the bartender and everybody in town were suspicious that my father was responsible for my mother's disappearance, so he immediately calls the Lewiston Police Department, concerned. Hey, Ralph's wife is missing, and now he's trying to hire a hitman to kill the captain of the police department. What do you want me to do? The police department says, agree to it. We'll send somebody in tomorrow. He's like, dude, Ralph knows every police officer in town. You know, he's had many run-ins. He's going to recognize anybody. So they said they'd specifically get an Idaho State Patrolman from out of town to play the role of the hitman. So this cop who doesn't know, you know, he doesn't know what he's getting put into, he has to go in and pretend to be the hitman that my father's hiring to kill this captain. And he sets my father up. He's has a recording on. He sets him up. My dad pays for the hit, agrees to be out of town during the hit, then starts to make arrangements to have two additional people murdered after he gets done taking care of the captain. And the hitman, who goes on to write a book, because he's a cop and he writes a book, he says, I don't know if this is going to muddy the waters, because when you're trying to get this one case solidified, you don't want to mess it up with multiple, you know, confusing. So he's like, I don't know what you're supposed to do when a guy's trying to hire multiple hits. I'm trying to just keep him focused on the cop so we can bust him on this. And it was funny because they're at a bar and he's like, I don't know if I'm supposed to order a drink. I'm on the job. I'm working. Am I supposed to be drinking? I'm a cop. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. He's just a cop, right? Playing the role of a hitman. So he gets the money, which then solidifies that my father hired a hitman. So within 2 months of losing our mother, we lost our father because he gets arrested for this attempted murder of the captain. My sister and I are then shuffled to a different home, which is his sister's house. Because at that time, I'm telling my mother's sister why my mom's not going to come home. Because I'm telling them what I saw, what I clearly saw. But I don't know the word for strangle. I don't even know what strangulation means when I'm three. I just explained to them what I saw. My dad didn't want us to be there anymore, obviously. That's why he removed us from that home and took us to his sister's house. So we stayed with his sister for about 4 years. And all of a sudden, he just showed back up and said, we're going home to that same house where I had watched my mother be strangled in front of me. And they let us go back to that home. I'm just so grateful that I had my sister because my sister was my mother and my father and my protector. She was everything. We were there only for about a year with my dad, and he was crumbling. He was falling apart. He was distraught all the time. He was intoxicated. He wouldn't come home. There were days that we went days and days with no parent even present because my dad would go off. He had multiple lady friends, and he would just be gone. So we would be calling family and saying, like, can you drop off a box of cereal? Like, if you get a chance, can you come over and just drop off some food because we hadn't eaten? You know, we're just kind of left on our own. We were 8 and 10 years old. About a year after dad was out, he packed us up completely unexpected. We didn't know what was happening, and he just said, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. I'm so sorry. I can't manage this, and you guys have to go back to my sister's house, which I'm fine with because obviously that was a stable home. My sister was not. She was very adamant that we stay with my father, and she was heartbroken that we had to go there again. And we were only there for about another year, a little less than a year, when our aunt sat us down and told us that our dad had died in police custody of a heart attack. So now we have no mother, no father. And we start getting curious. We're older now, you know, we're 10 and 12, and we start getting curious, like, how can we be 10 and 12 year old kids and we literally don't know what happened to our parents, right? We start asking questions and digging into it. And we discover a hidden folder full of all these newspaper clippings and court documents and everything about my father and my mother and the whole case. And it's like, wow. Our dad went to prison for hiring a hitman. Everybody suspects him of killing our mother. Like, everybody knows this. And I am so tired of every time I meet somebody and they're like, you're Dallas Otto. I felt like I was OJ Simpson's girlfriend. You know, the look you would get on their face is like, oh. Ooh. And so I asked my aunt, if you're going to change my last name, can I change my first name and no longer be Dallas Otto so that when people meet me, they're like, oh, Suzanne Smith sounds like an alias. I could be anybody. I'm never going to get that look again of like, oh, those are the Otto kids. You know who those kids are, right? So I legally changed my name. I got to pick it myself. Suzanne Smith, the most boring blank name that nobody will ever know who I am. And my sister wanted to keep her name, obviously. Like I've said, she was very much in support of my father and wanted to prove that my father had nothing to do with our mother's disappearance. When we graduate from high school, we're old enough to get the police records. So we go to the Lewiston Police Department and we're like, hey, we're Ralph and Patty Otto's daughters and we want to know what happened. And they're like, oh gosh, these girls are in for a rude awakening, right? Because here we've been supporting my father this whole time, thinking that the police department's the bad guy. They're the ones that killed our father. We get all the records, and I literally read, I think, 5 pages. And I remember turning to Natalie saying, Natalie, you know he did it. He's responsible. He did it. She did not agree. She wanted to insist that my father was innocent. He would never hurt our mother. Mom had ran off, and that we were going to find her alive. It is what it is. We don't agree, whatever. I still love my sister. She's still everything to me. We go about our merry lives. I get married. She gets married. And this is in Idaho. I'm in an abusive relationship at the age of 21. I have 2 little boys. And I decide I'm not going to sit around and wait till I kill him or he kills me because this relationship is not good. I've got to get out. So I leave Idaho and I move to Walla Walla, Washington to be close to my sister who was living here in Dayton, Washington. I didn't know anybody else here in Walla Walla. I get a job at the hospital. I had to divorce my husband, start dating after my divorce and my graduation from nursing school. And the first guy that I start dating, I end up marrying this guy. Great guy. My sister meets him. She loves him. She tells all the family that finally I have this great man in my life and everything's going to be wonderful for me. And in 2006, my nephew calls me to ask if the boys, my children, can go on this boating trip with them. And for the first time in my life, if for those of you that know me, I say no to nothing. I literally will do anything for anybody and I never say no. And I said no to her. She's like, are you mad at me? And I was like, no, I think I'll keep the boys home and then next weekend I'll take your son and we'll go do something. He called me back begging, please, I'm gonna be so bored out of my mind. Can I take one of the boys? And I was like, I don't ever separate my boys. They're 15 months apart. They're never away. No, I'll just next weekend, I'll get you. They all die together in a carbon monoxide poisoning accident. That weekend, he asked a friend to go with him, who was 12 years old, and all four of them died on the boat together. To say losing a sibling is devastating, nobody can understand that loss because she was my mother, my father, my everything. And I really grasped with the reality that, seriously, God, like, seriously, you're going to take all of them? I really thought it was not real that she had found something and that she had gone like into witness protection. I like trying to protect my mind. There's no way my sister's dead, right? There's no way. Yeah, I like refused to participate in the planning of the funeral, anything. I'm like, this is crap. It's not real. You guys are stupid if you really believe that my sister could die. There's no way. And at the funeral, I tried to open her casket and prove it to everyone, which didn't go over very well.
Suzanne was tasked with the horrific job of emptying out her sister Natalie, brother-in-law Jeff, and their son Jonathan's home after their tragic death from carbon monoxide poisoning while out boating on Memorial Day weekend. As she began the process of packing their newly built four-bedroom home, Suzanne came across the boxes upon boxes of documents, recordings, police reports, and more that Natalie and Suzanne had worked so hard to collect. With the heavy loss of her sister and her brother-in-law and nephew, she asked a friend to take those boxes for safekeeping because it was just too much to bear. It was just too hard to look at. So those boxes would remain untouched for years. In 2013, Suzanne had another tremendous loss. This time it was her 17-year-old son, Isaiah.
I just feel like I'm recovering from one big loss after another big loss after another big loss. And I'm like, losing Isaiah completely, completely took the wind out of my sails. And I obviously don't have time or energy or effort to be looking into a missing persons case. I'm at the lowest of low that any parent can ever be. 2013 took me years and years to just be able to put one foot in front of the other. Now, if I cared for you as a patient in the hospital, you would never know. because I can put on a good fake smile and act like my life is great. My life was not great. It was very painful. 2021, I'm thinking, hi, it's been like almost 10 years since I lost somebody. I'm doing really good. This is like going to be the first decade that I haven't lost somebody. And I'm laying in bed, scrolling through my Facebook, and I see this image of this penciled Jane Doe, and it's my face. And like, sit up. And I was like, that's so weird. That legit looks just like me. 15, 20 years ago. Obviously, I'm 50 now, so it doesn't look like me right now. But I was like, this picture looks just like me. I click on the image and I start searching the details of it. And it says that this body was found in Oregon in 1978. Well, that's odd. Our mom disappeared in 1976, and she's wearing red pants and a white blouse. That's really odd. I'm pretty sure that's what grandma and grandpa said my mom was wearing, and that's what the records show that my mom was wearing. Same pants and the same shirt, and her face looks like me. All the details. She's short, 5'2" to 5'4". The pants look like they've been hemmed. Blonde hair, Caucasian female in her early, what, 15 to 25 or something. And I'm like, oh crap. That's not a picture of me. That's my mom. How can I find my mom in a freaking Jane Doe poster 47 years after she disappeared? And so I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be reaching out to this Oregon police sounding like I'm a lunatic, right? Like, hey, I found my mom on a Facebook post. And I know my dad told us that she ran away, but I never really believed that because I saw him strangle her. And I'm pretty sure the Finley Creek Jane Doe is my mom. Yeah, I sound crazy. I sound even crazier when I get the actual 44-page homicide report that the Finley Creek Jane Doe Task Force had obtained, and I get to read the police report that also includes the newspaper clippings that were released for this Doe. And it says that she was found by two hunters from Milton Freewater, Oregon, which is just 10 minutes south of me where I'm at right now. And it lists the name of the two hunters, Ron Swiger and Lee Parr. Lee Parr is my husband's grandfather, and Milton Freewater is a town of like a couple thousand people. Say to my husband, honey, did your grandpa ever mention finding a body in 1978? And he's like, first you think the Jane Doe looks like you. Now you think my grandpa. Okay, you seriously sound crazy, right? You hear yourself. And I hand him the article, and he's like, Milton Freewater has like, and I said, I know. It would be different if you're talking LA and it had two guys named Lee Parr. No, Milton Freewater is this teeny tiny town, and Ron Swiger happens to be friends with Lee Parr. And he's like, whoa, wait, what? And that's why I said, okay, Grandpa Parr died in like 2008, so I'm gonna call your dad and see if your dad ever heard from Grandpa about this, because maybe he mentioned it to your dad. Now my father-in-law works up at the prison. He's like, no, don't call him. He could be at work. Are you serious? I don't care if he's at work. I think I found my mother who's been missing for 47. I'm not gonna wait till your dad gets off work. I don't care if he's at work. So when I call my father-in-law and I said, did your dad ever mention finding a body? He's like, mention it. It's not something you'd ever forget. He starts explaining to me that as they were walking back from elk hunting, that the other teenage boy that was with them is the one that found it. And he said the color just went out of the kid's face when they sat down around the fire, that the kid looked like he'd seen a ghost. And he tells his dad, I think I found human remains. And when they went back up on the hill to go find where the body was buried at, my father-in-law is a little boy. And he's the one that's like, that right there? He explains how the skull sticking up out of the ground, the animals had dug out the grave, that the jaw is turned upside down, laying a di short distance away from the skull. And I like have these pictures of the crime scene, and he's describing exactly how the body's positioned in the grave, how the boots are crisscrossed. He remembers all this. And I'm like, Rob, I know how crazy this sounds. I think you found my mother in 1978. And he's like, you just saw your mom last week. This happened in 1978. I'm like, Rob, you know I'm adopted. Then he's all, oh, you knew your birth mother? Yeah, I knew my birth mother. I was adopted at the age of 10. And people don't understand how it's like, how could you be married to him for all these years? Because I've been married since 2010. How could I be married to this man and this family, and at no point have this conversation of, I'm missing a mother and you found a body. Do you know how absurd it would sound if we had this conversation at dinner and he's like, oh yeah, I found a body once. I'm pretty sure it's your mom. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was wearing the same clothes. Yeah, that's probably the same per you would sound absolutely absurd if you even thought that there could be the chance that I am missing a mother and that you found her body when we were children. So he says, I don't want to hear anything else. Don't tell me anything else. I'm going to drive to that elk camp and I'm going to mark it with my little GPS thing that hunters do. And then I'll get a hold of Oregon State Police and say, look, when I was a child, my father and I were hunting and we found this body. And then I'll let them decide what they want to do with it. He goes to the spot, marks it with GPS, confirms with Oregon State Police he is in the exact location out in the mountains. We're talking miles from anything, right? I mean, if he would have been 5 miles away, they would have been like, that's really close. No, he's at the grave location. He thinks by going up the trail and following where the deer trails are at, he thinks he even knows. I think that's where the body was found. And it's odd because there was tree limbs laying there that were in a perfect square, almost like when they dug her up and had to fill the hole back in, that they laid that to say, like, if we ever had to come back, there's these four tree limbs laid out perfectly in a rectangle. And he's like, that they can't fall that way. Nothing in nature is going to fall in a perfect square. And he's like, that's where I'm remembering the location. From that point on, it's like we've contacted Oregon State Police. We found out that the case is closed. That basically what happened is in 1990, Oregon couldn't figure out who she was and how she died because she's just a dead pregnant woman laying in this grave and nobody ever came to claim her. So they made the decision to close her unsolved homicide, dispose of the remains, dispose of all the evidence, of course, with no paper trail. There's no paper trail saying that they took her clothes out of the murder evidence locker and destroyed them. No paperwork, no nothing. So here I am saying, look, I am very, very, very certain that that woman that you had was my mother. Can you please do a DNA or a dental check? Because surely you had dentals back in 1978. They did dentals, right? So we get the dental record for her, but there's no X-ray to support it. And the dental record shows this massive amount of dental work done on the doe, which is interesting because I said the jaw was laying with the teeth up, and you can actually see the teeth. And in the photos, you can see the teeth, and you can't see any massive dental work. He talks about fillings that extend from the molars all the way out that are almost like one big silver filling. You can't see any of that. So it seems really odd that what the writing says doesn't seem to match the pictures. And it's also odd that they're saying that Idaho never presented my mother as a match when I don't believe that. Because I remember when we were children, our grandparents told us that they think they found Patty and that they went to this place to go look at these clothes and they had had the same clothes that Patty was wearing, but they told them it wasn't our mom. And I'm like, I remember this. If I remember this, then that means Oregon does know that my mother was a missing person and they did know she was wearing red pants and a white blouse. Oregon sticks to it, saying, no, we never knew about your mom. Nope, nobody ever presented Patty as a match. I'm a nurse and I'm working from home and I was in a meeting. Again, I'm going to sound crazy. I hear my sister in my head telling me that I need to update her address on an E-Trade account, which I don't know what E-Trade is. And I just keep having this like, I have to change her address on this E-Trade. I don't know what it is. I think I even Googled, what's E-Trade? And it says it's some online, E-Trade for stock something. And I was like, well, I don't even know what E-Trade is. So why would I have this incessant thought that I need to update her address? So I had a mail file for her from back in 2007 when she died. And this is now 2021, right? In November, I have this mail file. And so I go and get her mail file and I pull out her mail that was sitting by her phone when she died and the mail that continued to come in. And I flip through it and I find this E-Trade statement that has her old address on it. And I was like, that is weird. I didn't know she had this account and I never updated it. And I'm like, oh, what if she invested into something crazy like Facebook and now she's got this account that's worth millions of dollars? And I'm like, oh, this is awesome. And I go to call the E-Trade and I see this police report right below the E-Trade account. And I'm looking at this police report and she has handwritten on it about the red pants and the white blouse. And it's this 5-page police report about when Idaho presented my mother to the Oregon Police Department, and she has the phone number to Umatilla County that she's calling them to say, "Hey, I know it's 2007. Have you guys ever identified that red pants doe?" She's literally calling them, and that's why it ended up in her mail instead of back into the police file. Well, hot damn. I can now go back to Oregon and say, "You guys are a bunch of liars," because she was 100% presented to you. Here's the names of the detectives that pulled the red pants and the white shirt out of the evidence to show my grandparents, who were flown in at midnight on a private plane because they were so certain it was our mom that they didn't want to waste any time. They flew them in at midnight to go to the state crime lab, met with all these people who were named. Who they are, what their titles are, what they're doing. And you're going to tell me this didn't happen, that Idaho just made this up back in 1970? No, in 1978, all this happened and Oregon didn't document one incident. Okay, so from that point on, now I have this report showing that, okay, obviously she was presented to them and they're like, "Oh, yeah, we did rule her out. Yeah, we did rule her out. We had the dental records and the x-ray, and we ruled her out." So I'm like, "Well, perfect. If you had an x-ray, let's pull that x-ray out again. Because I also have an x-ray of my mom. And if you have an x-ray of the doe, we can compare these two x-rays. Bam! Case solved." Guess what they can't find? No x-ray on the doe. And guess what? Idaho would have had to submit something to the national database to have a record on file for my mom. They have no x-ray for my mom. NamUs, NCIC, these national records have no dental records with an x-ray on file for my mother. They have a little note in her file saying she had all four wisdom teeth removed. And I'm like, where's the proof of it? If she had all four removed, where's the proof of it? I don't know. We never got an x-ray. So you've been ruling her out based off of a note saying she has no wisdom teeth when this Findlay Creek Jane Doe has three wisdom teeth. And in my mom's x-ray, one of hers is the most problematic. And her family remembers her getting one wisdom tooth pulled, not four wisdom teeth, one. So all of it lines up to show that it's 100% my mom. You can take the dental x-rays and lay them over the images of the autopsy photos of the teeth. You can see it's 100% her. I've taken it to multiple dental experts, odontologists, and had them look at it. And Oregon still says, "Ooh, that's really nice. But without DNA, we can't prove anything. This doesn't prove anything. Those could be your teeth that we're laying them over. And it just happens to be perfectly. This one's straight, this one's crooked, this one's turned. It's just exactly the same as someone else." So without DNA, Oregon refuses to admit that they took a pregnant woman who had been murdered, disposed of her, lost her, failed to ever give justice to her, and essentially covered up a murder that my father committed. So what I'm hoping is, number one, that science can advance enough to where if there's DNA out there in that forest, what if her DNA is like in the trees and in the bushes? What if science advances to say if a body was buried here 100 years ago, that DNA is going to exist in the life that's growing around here? What if science comes to that point? I mean, we never would have thought 100 years ago that you can dig up 4,000-year-old Egyptian remains and get DNA off of them. We never would have thought that all those years ago that science has advanced every year, leaps and bounds. My other thought is that as we started to dig into where the remains were sent, this is another weird coincidence. In 1990, LeGrand, Oregon, did not have a crematorium. So they sent her to the closest crematorium, which was across state lines, right here in Walla Walla, Washington. So she was sent in 1990 to Walla Walla, Washington to be cremated. So the Findlay Creek Task Force reaches out to the coroner to say, "Do you have any Jane or John Doe's?" He says, "No, we've never had a Jane or John Doe. However, I have a box of cremains that's sitting in a shelf, on a shelf in the basement, and it's labeled miscellaneous cremains. And we have an order from Oregon going out with the box of Findlay Creek's remains that says miscellaneous remains because it's the doe and her unborn child. So miscellaneous remains go out, and now we have a box of miscellaneous cremains that we do not have any missing persons unidentified here in Walla Walla County." So the coroner's like, "Oh, wow, this is more than likely your mom. Can we get DNA off of it?" So we've tried multiple times, and because of the cremation process, it burns and destroys the chains of DNA. However, again, science is advancing to where if you think of DNA as being chain links, multiple chain links, you just have these little pieces. You don't have a link. If DNA can advance to the point that the computer system could take those links and put the links back together and even get a short chain, what if the short chain would even just show that it's a Caucasian female of Irish descent? What if the short chain could be something that, like, hey, you could take my short chain, that short chain, and there's a relation between these two? What if that's a possibility? That's what I'm hoping. Or that forensic odontologists could say, hey, if you have five odontology experts review the x-rays and the photos and that all five agree, that's the same person. Could that force Oregon to say, look, with or without DNA, everything points to that that's my mother. But yet I'm left 48 years later being told I may never get answers to a child who was told her whole life that her mother abandoned her and that what I saw that night was a bad dream. That I just dreamt that and continued to dream that dream over and over again because it was living in my mind of that I felt like I should have done something differently and I could have had a different outcome. Children don't do that when they're 3 years old. Children don't envision things like that and continue to see them over and over and over again. So I think that leads me to where we're at right now, to where it's like I'm just at this dead end in the investigation, to where I'm like, I want to be able to close it. I want to know without a shadow of a doubt that my mom never left me. She's been here the whole time, and that her and my sister are somehow working from the other side to be like, I am going to lead you to the answers, whether you want to or not, because I just cannot believe that the universe would put me right here in this spot to be right here with this man who I'm married to, who his family found this body in 1978 and could possibly give me closure that I have waited for all this time.
Listening to Suzanne's story and all of the events that have taken place in her life to lead her to where she is today really blows my mind. From remembering what she saw at just 3 years old to losing her sister and being put in charge of those documents and police reports, but not wanting anything to do with them, to then struggling with the loss of her son, and just a few years later, laying awake in bed, scrolling Facebook, and stumbling upon a sketch of a Jane Doe that oddly resembled herself. Learning that this Jane Doe was found less than 2 hours north of where her mother went missing. Only to find out that this Jane Doe was discovered by her husband's grandfather and father. Then this voice in the back of her mind telling her to change the address for an account her sister had, only to find a piece of the puzzle that Oregon said didn't happen. I feel that there are just too many coincidences here, and that all of this unfolded for a reason. It's unexplainable and truly astonishing how the stars have aligned.
Unbelievable. And I'm literally, so I'm finishing up my master's right now, and I'm in a statistics course, and we talk about the probability of something happening, right? And so we've calculated out with science the probability of something like this happen. And it's like you are literally a one in quadrillion people with the incidences that have happened in your life. Don't tell me that that's just randomly happening. It's not randomly happening. There is something that pulled me here, something that pulled me to him, something that pulled that family to that trail. I mean, it's just, it is just, I seriously think that there's power beyond the grave that we don't understand. And that's kind of scary. It's kind of scary when you think of that. And there's so much, I mean, there's so much of the story that I leave out because it's like I could sit here and talk for hours and hours and hours. But to get to the basics of it, essentially, I was lied to my entire life. My father is a terrible person who got away with horrible things. The reason he got out in 1983 is because he had money. And he fought his conviction, and they said, the Supreme Court said, you know what? You're right. He didn't attempt to murder someone. He solicited for the murder of someone because that cop was never going to kill the captain. So it was never going to happen, but he solicited it. He should have been charged with solicitation of murder. He got away with it. And he wanted to kill a judge, he wanted to kill a friend. No innocent person tries to kill cops, judges, and friends. He's doing this because he's trying to cover his tracks. 100% trying to cover his tracks.
As Suzanne told us at the beginning of this episode, the day after her mom disappeared, her father was to help his girlfriend move to California. I was curious if she had reached out to this girlfriend to ask her questions and to see if maybe she knew something more about what happened to her mom and what the girlfriend had to say about her father. And this is what Suzanne said.
Yeah, she did. And actually, in December of that year that she disappeared, my dad calls her when she's in California and he's hallucinating. And he says, I need you to get my attorney over here and call my brother. And she's like, why? What's going on? And he said, oh, Patty came out of the grave and she tried to stab me. And so I had to shoot her. And she's like, she came out of her grave? And he's like, yeah, there's cops everywhere. They're all around here. And he's having conversations and talking to people as if they're there. And she said, put them on the phone. He's talking to the cops and she can't hear anything back. So she calls my dad's brother and says, hey, Ralph's down there with the police. And he says that Patty came back out of the grave and that he shot her. And so Ray says, don't call the cops. The uncle says, don't call the cops. I'll be right there. And when he shows up, my dad's crawling all around on the ground, completely hallucinating out of it. They go and admit him to a mental hospital and tell him not to say anything else. Stop talking. Don't say anything else. And I'm like, so by December, the guilt is just eating my dad up. And now he's now hallucinating that she's coming out of the grave that he put her in. And he's justifying why he had to kill her because she's coming after him from the grave.
Suzanne and I were discussing where the Jane Doe had been found and the fact that her father would have had to travel from Idaho to Oregon to bury her. She tells me an interesting fact that is just one more piece to almost prove that the Fenley Creek Jane Doe is her mother.
If my dad were to drove from Lewiston, he could have came into Washington and went down, or he could go around and go down to like Joseph, Oregon. You might have been to Wallowa Lake. That would be the way to go. And it's also interesting that we found there was a police report documented that like September 2nd or 3rd that my dad got a speeding ticket in Asotin County, which is Washington, and that is on the way to go to this area. And he was speeding. And I'm like, I can just picture if I just buried my spouse, I'm going to be so out of my mind. I'm not paying attention to anything. And this is days after her disappearance. And I'm like, what was he doing over there? Bonnie had already left. She moved that day. He loaded her up and she moved. So there was no reason for him to be over there, but he was caught speeding and it was documented in the police report. I mean, there's just way too many things. And over again, he also said at times when he was being interviewed, he would say, I can't believe my girls haven't ratted me out. That's because he saw us standing there. He knows we saw him. And then it makes me think that my sister also saw it, but she refused to admit it or believe it. She went to a hypnotherapist and she told me, you're never to go. It is terrible. Don't do it. It will traumatize you. Don't ever do it. And I'm like, I know exactly why you don't want me to go, Nat. I know exactly why you don't want me to go, because you saw what we saw that night again, and you don't want me to relive it again. She wants me to think it was a bad dream and never happened, because that's so much easier to handle than we just watched him kill her.
As Suzanne mentioned earlier, it was reported that the Fenley Creek Jane Doe was pregnant at the time of her murder and burial. I asked Suzanne if this was a surprise to her.
Yeah, definitely. And it's still like not even 100% for sure, because the reason they thought she was pregnant is they found small bones near the abdominal cavity when they were digging her up. Was it a dead squirrel? Was it small bones that her finger bones had fallen down into the cavity of the stomach because the way that she rotted? I mean, if there was a small fetus and they said it was 12 inches from crown to rump, if they had photos of this fetus, if there was an autopsy report on a fetus, if there was a death certificate on a fetus, then I would be like, yes, 100%. There was suspicion that she was pregnant, and this ball of dirt and the bones went to the hospital to go be x-rayed, and it returned, and then there's never any more mention about the fetus. So did they lose the fetus? Was there a fetus? Or did the x-ray come back and they're like, oh, no, that was just the floating ribs? I mean, you know, the people at the scene aren't used to seeing skeletalized remains. So it could just be like, oh, no, those are floating ribs. Those belong there. Those were not human fetal remains. But no documentation of it. Nothing ever again. And then the state is required to do a death certificate for the Doe. They didn't even do that. There's no death certificate for her. Her autopsy report, it just looks like the most generic. I found a, skeletal remains. No date on the autopsy report. It was sometime in August. It's the whole thing. It's like, so what happens then is that me and a cousin of mine who were the same age, and she was like, "Look, I want to help you dig into this. I'm really good at details. I've been a part of this my whole life because obviously she's my family and she's lived there. I want to help you." And she's digging through the whole report and she's like, "You guys, it's really clear to see what happened." So my mom disappears August 31st. 2 years later, August 13th, Oregon releases a all points bulletin saying, "Hey, we found a Jane Doe buried near Portland, Oregon, and it's a Caucasian female." So they put out the all points bulletin, and Lewiston police receives that all points bulletin. And you can see that they get it and that they say, "Hey, 2 years, that's about the time frame that Patty Otto disappeared. Let's go get a copy of her x-rays and send it on over." They get the x-rays, they write in a letter. August 27th, they find Findlay Creek Jane Doe. August 28th, Lewiston sending the letter out to say, "Hey, I think that Doe you have is my woman." The detective gets a call on September 1st saying, "Did you know that Doe in Oregon was wearing red pants and a white blouse?" And that's when the detective's like, "Are you kidding me? Why didn't they mention that when I called? I'm literally sending in requesting a comparison." He doesn't know that Eastern Oregon has a new Jane Doe. He's talking about the Portland Jane Doe, right? This is important because this explains why the teeth are wrong. He flies my grandparents there, and nobody still says, "Why would you be talking to Portland? Why would you be talking to them about this homicide?" Because he tells them, "I've been on the phone. I've already had conversations with Multnomah County, which is Portland. They know I've sent the request." But he said, "Nobody told me red pants and a white blouse. So here's the parents. Yes, those are the same clothes. 100% case closed. That's my girl." The girl in Portland was identified by her extensive dental work. The girl in Portland is the one that had the massive molars and all this issues with her teeth. So we pull the girl in Portland's records and we sit them next to the Findlay Creek, and they literally wrote the exact same thing on both dental records because they never got an x-ray. So they were like, "Oh shoot, I think it was, oh, I don't know if they said, I think it was," or they pulled the report, same 14 or 17 fill. It's a ridiculous amount of fillings, the exact same fillings on that dough as what they had on the other dough. So when they get the x-ray for my mom, they're like, "Oh no, it's not, that isn't her, because Patty only has two tiny fillings and this doe has like 17, so it's not her." They immediately just ruled her out. They're talking about the wrong freaking dental records. They're not even looking at the right skull.
After hearing all that Suzanne had done to fight for answers for her mom, only to be faced with what seems like a crappy investigation, a very disorganized investigation and disorganized way that it was handled, I asked her if she has ever received an apology from Oregon, despite being told initially that the Findlay Creek Jane Doe wasn't her mom. And this is what she had to say.
"No, and Oregon's not denying it's my mom. Oregon State Police will tell you 100%. You have convinced me that was 100% Patty Otto. How do we get her identified? How do we help you with this?" And I'm like, "So you don't think I'm crazy?" He's like, "No, there is absolutely no way that we discovered a body with the same hair, clothing, height, age, time of death, cause of death, which was strangulation. This woman wasn't shot, murdered, butchered up. She was strangled. Just like I had told them back in 1976, what I had saw." He's like, "That's your mom. So what do we do?" And so we go to the Oregon State Medical Examiner, and she's the one, Dr. Nisi Vance, is the one saying, "I collect bones and I do DNA. That's how I identify. I can't say without a shadow of a doubt that that's your mom, even though everything seems to point that way. I can't do that. I have to have DNA evidence." So I said, "Then pull the clothes. Pull the clothes out of the evidence locker and we will do a DNA. My DNA is on file. Pull the clothes." And they can never find that they ever even entered them into the evidence locker, even though I have that report showing, "Yes, you did." I think they got sat on his desk and they thought it was a slam dunk solve. So they never, processed the evidence appropriately. And a week later, when they come back and say that wasn't Patty Otto, they were like, "Wait, which case do these clothes go to? I don't know. Just set them off to the side." Who knows where those clothes ever went? There was boots, clothes, top, shoes, and multiple pieces of fabric that would be drenched in her DNA. And there is no proof that Oregon ever processed that evidence, let alone destroyed it.
What's frustrating is that DNA, x-rays, the works weren't done for this Fenley Creek Jane Doe. A lot of boxes weren't checked. The T's were not crossed, the I's were not dotted, yet they sent her off to be cremated, completely forgotten about. Suzanne has been fighting an uphill battle since she came across that penciled sketch of the Jane Doe in 2021, and her fight and drive is still as fierce as ever. I asked her what could be done in the case to give her closure and for her to feel like it's been solved when so many things weren't done to allow that. Had DNA been taken, the clothing handled properly, x-rays taken, the outcome would have been different. And without all of those things and the Jane Doe now being cremated, I wanted to know what the next step was for her.
Oregon just admitting that all signs point to her, and that if they use the technology that they had then, which would be, if you look at cases that were in the 50s and 60s, and they pulled, let's say Dane Paulson's body was pulled out of the water, he's wearing the same clothes he was when he disappeared. They know it's Dane. Do they really need to do DNA on him? They would just identify him in 1960 and say, here's Dane. We found him. He's wearing the same clothes. That's it. Why can't they do the same thing with my mother? Here's her body. She's wearing the same clothes. She 100% matches. And now the forensic image that 100% looks like me, there is no way they just draw this based off of this skeletal image unless there is some relation. It's like, why don't they just use that? Why don't they use like, oh, all signs point to Patty Otto. And yeah, you're right. We're really sorry. We let your dad, not only did we let your dad get away with murder, we allowed you to go back into that home where I am starting to question that he was a sexual predator. And he could not resist his urges anymore. And he's like, I have to get you girls out of here. I can't resist this anymore. And he packed us up and he brought us back out there. And he protected us. Because despite being a horrible person, he loved us dearly. And that's really hard for people to understand why you would protect a murderer. He was a good dad to us. Really hard to say that. Like, oh, I love my dad. And my sister loved my dad. And he was a... He was a wild father. He was a wild man. He wasn't ready even at his age. In his 40s, he wasn't ready to be a father. He wanted to be this crazy wild outlaw and a womanizer. And it's like, he just wasn't ready. Still love him dearly.
As I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, Suzanne has a solid following on TikTok. She has made it her mission now to fight for answers for her mom and has since used social media to gain massive recognition. I asked her to tell me a little bit about social media and how she got started with using it to advocate for her mom.
So when we discovered all this, I'm like, okay, so maybe we can get attention if we get a Facebook page, which is so old school, right? Because I'm old. I'm going to go Facebook. I've had the Facebook page since 2021. We have less than like maybe 4,000 followers. I don't even know. It's really small. And then TikTok came out, and I have younger kids, right? I have a 14-year-old kid. TikTok's the rage, man. You need to be on TikTok. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to figure out. I've never even figured Instagram out. So I decided I'm going to go on TikTok then. And I'll share the story on TikTok. And on TikTok, obviously the social media gathering or the group is much larger. And so we have like 20 plus thousand people on there. And I was able to reach larger platforms of people, which you've probably seen them out there. Like I said, Gabulosis and all those are finding me on TikTok because they're like, wait, tell me about this story. How is this even possible? Dateline has reached out to us via TikTok because that's how they saw my mom's story. So Dateline covered her. News Nation covered her.
So like I said, Suzanne and I have been working on trying to make this episode happen for a few years now. And when she reached out to me after the new year to see if we could finally make this come together, she had mentioned when we were chatting about her being involved with something for Netflix. And I wanted to hear more about what that was. And here is what she said.
So back up when my son died in 2013, that was about the time that 13 Reasons Why came out from Netflix, very popular series. And the school had sent home something with my other children saying, be very cautious of this series. It's completely displays suicide in a way that sensationalizes it and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, wait a minute. I want to know what this is about, because if Hannah's suicide actually brings awareness to people of what happens. That's the character. And it prevents people from doing what she did because they see the aftermath of what happened and how everybody carries this guilt forever. It ruins all these kids' lives. I mean, if you've seen the series, you can see that each kid gets a tape and that they're like, oh, I had a part in it. We do all have a part. We do all carry a part. And so I had spoke out and I had been speaking at like community events in honor of my son to bring awareness to suicide. And I had done some kind of interview in Tri-Cities, which is a larger news network. And the producer had alerts set and she somehow saw my interview and reached out to me via social media and said, I'm the producer of 13 Reasons Why. We saw your thing, blah, blah, blah. We were wondering if we could talk to you. Well, I spoke with her a couple of times and then she said, the mom that plays the actress on there, she would really love an opportunity to meet with you because she doesn't have kids of her own and never been a mother. And she's playing this part and she's just wondering if you would feel comfortable talking with her about your journey, your grief, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, how am I going to help some actress who's never, whatever, I'll do anything, right? Well, when I met with Kate, she was like, it'd be better if you were here. Can you come on site and come talk to our staff and the actors and actresses so that it really gives a real face to the prevention efforts that we're doing? And I was like, I'm a nurse. I'm a mom. I don't see myself as being some kind of Hollywood actress going down there to go speak to these big actors and actresses. Kate, I mean, Kate's amazing, right? So my daughter and I fly down to Napa, and we were supposed to be meeting her the next day on set. And we're out at dinner, and Kate comes walking in, all like in disguise. She was like, I just wanted to meet you before. I just wanted to spend some time with you before. She sits down, has wine, has dinner with us. And I'm like, this is really weird. I'm getting to know her on a personal level rather than it being like her character on TV. And she was like, I'm just so appreciative of you being willing to share this pain with me because if I can show any bit of what you're feeling rather than me being what I think I should be doing and carrying Isaiah's legacy. So I'm like, oh my gosh, I end up being a parent advocate. I was on 13 Reasons Beyond the Reasons. I'm on there with her and their psychiatrist. We were on set multiple times. My whole family was there. We celebrated with them when they did release of season two, season three. Well, about 2 months ago, a producer reached out. You can't just present your case to Netflix for a documentary. It has to be brought in by a producer. So I have a producer right now who's doing all the interviews, and he's going to be doing a pitch to Netflix, which is how they do it. And I'm hoping that what that does is it pressures Oregon to be like, if Netflix picks this up as a documentary and Netflix actually shows all the evidence and shows how everybody's pointing to that Finley Creek is my mom, he said it can really pressure agencies and the governor of Oregon to say, we look stupid. We look absolutely insanely stupid right now. Number one, for what we did, and number two, for what we're not doing. So I'm like, go for it. Freaking pressure them. Put the story out there because all these other little things are doing nothing. I think people watch Dateline and News Nation and they're like, that isn't real. And they just skip it over, right? That my mom's story is not real. They're like, there's no way. That chick is crazy. That didn't happen. I have the reports. I have the documentation. I could show it to you.
Ultimately, I think for this case to reach its end goal of closure, continued pressure is going to be needed. And if this documentary goes through, I think that's going to be a tremendous boost in the pressure Oregon feels. I admire Suzanne so much because she just keeps fighting and fighting for her mom. Even when the days get tough, she keeps finding new ways to keep the pressure going.
Actually, I've had experts. They had me present to this worldwide panel of experts. They were like FBI attorneys, all this. And they were like, it's 100% your mom. Until you get an attorney who's going to sue the state of Oregon to prove to them that you don't want this to ever. And I'm like, I am just not the litigious kind of person. I'm not going to bring her back by doing that. But they're like, you're not going to bring her back, but you're going to stop another family from going that route. And I'm like, but you don't understand. I don't have the time and energy to be going through a freaking legal battle. I'm adopted. In 2022, I held my adopted mother while she died in my arms. 1 year later, my adoptive father says, hey, can you hook me up with what you did to mama? Because I'm ready to go. I'm retiring. And I'm like, Dad, it doesn't work that way. You don't just get to put in your notice. Well, I'll be damned if he didn't. So I lost her and then I lost him 1 year back to back, January 22, January 23. And because both of them are gone, I inherit my disabled adult brother in the same month that I get laid off from work. My daughter goes into preterm labor and I take on full-time responsibility of my brother, and I'm in school full-time. I don't have time for a legal battle. Just don't have time. I know that sounds crazy, but it's like I have my priorities. I want to finish school. I want to care for my brother. I want my daughter to be cared for. I don't want them to think I can't be here. I have to go to a litigation or I have to go to a hearing. No, then right now is not the time for me or for my family. My family is my priority. I do this in my very part-time free time that I managed to find.
Before we wrap up, Suzanne did tell me more about things that pointed further to her dad being involved in her mother's disappearance and things that didn't quite add up. So let's listen to what she had to say.
His brother has this journal of what he was doing on the 31st, the 1st, the 2nd, the 3rd, the 4th, and there's this one whole day that's just blank. That's like, why wasn't that a big red flag to you guys at the time that he couldn't explain what he did or where he was? What they do know is on the 1st, he went and bought four new tires, and there's a receipt and there's a check for four new tires. Why would you need four new tires the day after your wife goes missing? Maybe you were going to go off-roading. And because he knows that when you get out there, you can get a flat tire because you run over something and you don't want to be stranded with a dead body in your car. So he buys four new tires and a big toolbox. And we have that receipt. So we can see that he did that. We can also see that when the Avon lady shows up to come deliver her stuff, he says, "Don't ever come back here again. She's never coming back again. Don't ever come back." Okay, if she ran off, why wouldn't she just be back? She had an order for Avon every freaking week. Why is he telling the Avon lady, "Don't ever come back here again. She's never coming back"? Because he knows. Why didn't he go to one friend? So I went. Now, in my adult time, I went to all of his friends. He called two friends at like 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. "I need help. I am in big trouble." And they said, "Dude, it's 2 in the morning. Call me tomorrow." He never let him know what that was about. It's the night she's disappeared. It's the night he was like, "Holy, what have I done?" And both those friends, when I go to talk to them, I was like, "What do you think?" And he was like, "Well, I'll tell you what. If your mom had really ran off with another man, he would have been out hounding every single one of us. Have you seen her? Have you seen her? Have you seen her?" He never asked for her again. He never looked for her. He never asked for her. It's because he knew exactly where she was. So even his own friends are saying, "I'm sorry, honey. He did it."
I asked Suzanne one final question, and it was if she had anything extra that she wanted to say.
That advocates and people like the Findlay Creek Jane Doe Task Force that just are random community members who picked up that case. They Googled Doe's in Union County, which is this little tiny county in eastern Oregon, and she was shocked to see that they had one that nobody knew anything about. And when they got the case file, it was closed case. So they opened it up as far as like, "I can look at everything. I can get her a forensic image. I can do all this." Anybody can do that. Anybody can advocate within their community. And if somebody had been doing that for my mom back home, maybe my grandparents wouldn't have died such young deaths. They were carrying this weight of carrying this horrific, knowing that she was either out there alive and being held against her will, or that he had just killed her that night. They don't know, but my grandparents both died very young, carrying this with no community member stepping in to say, "How can we advocate for your missing daughter? You have a 24-year-old mother of two who's missing, and nobody says a peep from 1976 to 1997. Not one person says a peep about it." That's extremely disappointing to me, especially when you think of how small Lewiston is. Lewiston's a town of 28,000 people. It's a small town. How did her case just go silent like that for all these years? But what you do when you share your cases and you share the stories of the cases that haven't been talked about for, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you're giving that family the knowledge that they weren't forgotten.
That last comment that she said about letting the families know they're not forgotten gave me goosebumps. Because if you've been listening for a long time, you know that I always say with my Missing Mondays and even Unsolved Murders that I never want a family to feel forgotten. My mission with Missing Mondays is to spread awareness and to let the family and friends know that their loved one matters to me and my listeners, and they will not be forgotten. And they will be talked about until they come home. Lastly, before I wrap up, I just want to say that since the recording of this interview with Suzanne, she has posted on the Patty's Voice Facebook page that the latest update is that Oregon has a new medical examiner, which is something that they are hopeful will bring a fresh set of eyes to Patty's case. Make sure you check the description of this episode to find all of the Patty's Voice social medias. Please go show Suzanne some love and engage in her content. The more engagement, the better the chance that her story will land in the right lap. I just want to say thank you again so much to Suzanne for joining me and sharing her mom's story. I have to tell you guys that, as you heard, Suzanne has gone through a tremendous amount of loss in her life. If you see her on social media, she always has a smile on her face. Suzanne, I truly admire your strength, your determination, your drive, but most of all, I admire that no matter the loss that you've dealt with, you manage to keep fighting and doing it so gracefully with a smile on your face. I look forward to staying in touch with you and watching your journey with your mom's story. That is all for this week's Missing Monday. I appreciate you guys tuning in and listening to Suzanne talk about her mom's story. I will be back later this week with another new episode. Until then, be aware and take care. Bye-bye.